this week on The Inside Flap.
And at some point, for a number of reasons that really make no sense at all, Williams decided that he had to kill a significant piece of his workforce and enlisted Clyde Manning to help him.
Wow.
And did so with the threat that if he didn't help him, Clyde Manning would be the next guy who died.
Mm. You
know, he'd start with him.
And I see hovered over the soundboard is Deb.
Oh.
And she is flustered and she is jabbing at buttons. She's like Mike Tyson jabbing away at this soundboard.
That's her nature.
Punching,
yeah.
Punching. And
that's
you know
her
that's her nature. You know I'm not exaggerating
no,
when
you
I
are
tell
not.
You this.
You are not.
She looks over at me with just got this murderous look in her eyes.
Yeah, like the square peg round hole. That won't stop her. She
no.
will force
oh, no.
it
She'll
in.
Force.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado. This is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Seated across the room, seated across the desk from me is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
Howdy. And we are happy to have you with us for this Inside Chat edition of the Inside Flap. What's going on there?
I feel like I don't hear you very well.
You can't hear me. Well, that's we can't have that.
Yeah.
I can see the.
All right, that's fine.
I'm fine. Anyway, welcome to the show.
The Inside Flap.
Got a great guest for you. We are joined by acclaimed New York Times bestselling author of Chesapeake Requiem, Earl Swift. His new book out now is Hell Put to Shame, the 1921 Murder Farm Massacre and the Horror of America's Second Slavery. And what a great book it is. And we'll have that conversation for you in just a second.
But first, as far as we know, because we did forget to ask him, not related to Taylor.
Earl Swift. We did not ask Earl Swift. He's related to Taylor Swift. That's true. Forgot to do that. But first, a couple of quick work stories for you. First off, there's nothing like showing up to school. Listen, I came up, pulled up my pickup truck, parked on the street. First of all, a little tip off that something was off. There's plenty of parking available when I pulled up right around 8 o'clock.
It's April.
But it's not that. It's not the street sweeping. There's lots of spots available.
I get in trouble this time every year.
Ooh, I got, yeah, me too. I was like, ooh, I got lucky. There's lots of parking available. Park the truck right across the street. I park around back on Detroit Street, if anybody wants to know.
I have a thing. Okay. So I drive and park in the city all the time.
Yeah.
And isn't it funny how when we see beautiful parking.
Oh, how exciting.
We're so dumb. Yeah. We don't ever question it. And we should be like,
true.
Wait, is it third Wednesday in April?
Know something's wrong.
Is it the fourth Wednesday?
Right.
Is it whatever day?
Yeah. Usually it's that. Is there a film being filmed around here? What's going on?
Oh, do you guys
on?
Have film?
No, I've never had that. Or is it not New York?
You know? Wow.
But,
usually.
I don't know. I'm just throwing things that could possibly
be. That'd
be
fun.
Well, I did. I walked across the street and I did not see, usually at 8 o'clock, you'll see kids who are starting. Most kids go in the front, but there are kids, a lot of kids whose parents drop them off. First of all, they park right in the middle of the street. When I'm driving down the street, let their kids out. It's a pain in the butt.
Parents love to do that though.
But you'll see kids starting to get inside the building. I don't see any kids. I'm like, what? And for a second, I got very excited. I'm like, ooh, maybe a water main broke and there's no school. But then there'd still be the kids around. There's no kids there. So I go into the building and it's deserted. And usually at 8 o'clock, there's all kinds of kids milling around because the doors have just been opened.
Huh.
And the kids who've been in the commons are filling in the hallways. The kids are coming in the front door, back door. There's nothing there.
Hmm.
I'm like, well, what is going on?
Oh.
I see a teacher around in the corner. I said, hey, what's the deal? He's like, it's a Thursday block schedule today. And this was on a Tuesday. I said, well, when did this happen? He said, didn't you see it on the email? I said, no, I didn't see it, because that's the problem.
When you asked him, what's the deal? Did he have to say, what do you mean?
Well, yeah, I think.
Or did you follow up?
I was looking around and I had my hands out.
Oh, okay. So he figured that out.
I was like, what's going on?
Yeah.
And he says, a Thursday block schedule. And he's like, yeah, so that's what I need to do, is make sure. I'm so quick. I don't like to have any emails in my inbox.
No.
I like a nice, clean inbox.
It annoys me about you, because I will say, oh, did you read that? You will have deleted it.
Quick to
delete.
You'll
have no record of whatever it was.
Well, because you can always get them out of the trash.
Yeah, but like.
But what I do is I don't, like, sometimes I'm in such a hurry to delete that I won't read the full email. So clearly there was one. Everyone knew. Teachers knew. The students knew. But so now I'm at school. It's 8 o'clock. And because it's a Thursday schedule, I don't have a class until 10:40.
Oh, Dave.
Over 2 hours and 45 minutes, basically.
Aww.
Almost 3 hours.
Aww.
That I could have slept in. I could have gone somewhere for a nice trail run. A million things I could have done.
That's too bad. What'd you do?
I went for a run.
Okay.
You know,
that's
but
fine.
It wasn't a nice trail run. It was
a city run.
A city run. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that was me showing up early to school. But then last Thursday, I showed up once again in the morning, showed up around 7:55. Thursdays, we have our meeting days. Sometimes it's our department. Sometimes it's an all-staff meeting. A lot of times the all-staff meetings are in the commons. Sometimes they're in the auditorium.
Okay.
And then sometimes it's a pain when we got the production going on and I've got to move set pieces out of the way because I got a big giant screen that comes down over the stage where they project the slideshow on. And a lot of times we might have stuff in the way that I've got to clear out.
Sure.
Production is over. No worries there. But I walk in and I see hovered over the soundboard is Deb.
Oh.
And she is flustered. And she is jabbing at buttons. She's like Mike Tyson jabbing away at this soundboard.
That's her nature.
Punching,
yeah.
Punching. And
that's
you know that's her nature. You know I'm not exaggerating when I tell you this.
You are not.
She looks over at me with just got this murderous look in her eyes.
Yeah, like the square peg round hole. That won't stop her. She
will force it in.
Yeah, and make it work.
She has got the bright, burning intensity of 1,000 suns, and she's looking at me. And I started to panic. I think she's going to, you know, start yelling at me.
Uh-huh.
She
wants you to do it, right?
She goes, she knows, here's, and we'll get to it. What she says to me, she goes, I'm going to kill him.
Oh.
And I look around and I put two and two together. The other choir teacher, or one of the two choir teachers, is they're rehearsing for their show in there. They've got their mixing board plugged into our board.
Oh.
And it's all, the sound is all messed up. And there are she's picking up these wireless mics and keeps saying test, test, test. And there's nothing coming out of the sound system. They need these wireless mics for the meeting.
No,
the meeting that's about to happen. As people are slowly walking in and filling up the auditorium. Now these teachers.
Where's the choir director then?
Well, nowhere to be seen.
Oh no.
No, not only that, he's not answering his phone.
Oh no.
Right. And the problem is, like, Deb knows the soundboard a little bit.
Yeah.
Our students
know it inside and out. Yeah.
And the one student, Elizabeth, she's got a doctor's appointment, so she can't come in. And Jonas, she calls Jonas, and because the students don't have to be there for another hour.
Oh, he's going to be asleep. They're going to be asleep.
She woke him up.
Oh.
And apparently it was a lot of that going on when he answered the phone. It was
I'm impressed he answered the phone.
Well, apparently his alarm had just gone off.
Oh, okay.
And he was just like lying in bed.
Oh, I gotcha.
So it's just me and her, and she knows. And this came up later on that, Dave, you need to learn this board. And the problem is, it's embarrassing for me as the technical director.
Oh, that you don't know the board.
I have no idea how
to
run this board.
When you first started at East, you had a student
right.
who felt like they owned the board.
Yeah, exactly. And didn't
and
want
did
me to.
And did not want to show
no.
you. And didn't like you.
No,
also.
Did not. The sound and light person, neither
yes.
one of them liked me, wanted me anywhere
yes.
near that.
So they shut you out.
They did.
And
they
so
did.
Then I guess you have felt embarrassed to say,
well,
you
that,
know,
yeah.
I would just share with Jonas and the other one, just say, show me.
Well, we've set it up. So after senior projects are over and the last the last couple of weeks of May where we have literally nothing to do.
Nothing
we're gonna,
at
they're,
all.
Yeah, they're going to be, well, in techno, in stagecraft. Sure. In stagecraft.
Sure.
They're going to show. But the problem is, like, the faculty, they don't know this.
No, they shouldn't.
They know.
They shouldn't have
I'm
to
the
know
technical
it.
Guy. So what happens is the woman goes up, the AP, and she says in her mouse seat.
They don't know that you don't know.
Do you think these teachers line up neatly and sit in the first couple of rows? No, they are scattered. There's a massive auditorium.
It's human beings.
You know, the school is where we have 2,500 kids at this school. It's a huge auditorium.
It's massive.
And these teachers are scattered all around, like chess pieces all over the place. The majority of them want nothing to do with sitting in the front, you know.
Yeah.
So she goes, we're having technical difficulties, and I can feel, and I'm right now I'm staring down at the basically I've got my so Deb's, you know, she's a whirling dervish, she's running around. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about this system. I've got my hands in my pockets and I'm just staring at it, and then I feel as she says this,
all the
200
heads.
Or so heads turn, swivel, and look back. Now, Deb is crouched. She's on the other side of the table. She's crouched down, pulling out wires, and I'm just
standing there. With your hands in your pockets.
I quickly jerk my hands out of my pockets.
You got to pretend that you're doing
pretending
something.
Pretending to do something. And that's when Deb looks up, and I can see, like, she's, like, looking at me, like, why, what are you doing?
Why
you don't know what the hell
you're
doing.
Why did you spring into action now?
Why are you pretending to do something?
Well, she might have thought, like, oh, he remembered, or whatever.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so that's how that went. And finally, we got one of the other choir teachers, not the guy who never answered his phone all day long, he's semi-retired, teaches two classes. But he's the one who messed up the board to begin with.
Oh.
Never owned it. Never said anything to us about it. Never said, hey, what was that phone call about?
That's weird.
Nothing. Yeah.
Huh.
Yep. But the other choir teacher came in and got it fixed.
But you are going to learn it.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt.
I'm surprised you haven't been called on to help before, because I feel like that's something that...
Usually Deb has been able... Well, no. You know what?
It's a student.
It's always a student. Usually Elizabeth. Usually Elizabeth.
You know, when we go to things at Sylvia's school, they have a student running the board.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a student. I've never seen a teacher touching
and
the board.
Over the last couple of years, I don't need to learn how to use it because these kids know it inside and out.
Yeah. And I think that's the same at Littleton.
Right.
Because I've never seen a teacher running it. It's always people. It's a student run thing.
And our kids,
thing.
They get paid. If they're working the pop show after school, they're getting paid. They're getting $10 an hour. If the lighting person is designing something the dance show, they're getting $20 an hour.
Because our band director will have a kid there that I've never seen before.
Right.
I think is in the theater department, probably.
Yeah, I'm sure, for the stagecraft class.
That's interesting.
So hopefully they're getting paid. But I don't know if other schools do that.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's nice.
Yep, that is nice.
Cash under the table, or how does that work?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, nice.
Wink, wink, nudge. Cash.
Okay.
All right, let's get to it. Our guest is Earl Swift. His new book is called Hell Put to Shame, The 1921 Murder Farm Massacre and the Horror of America's Second Slavery. I dove into this book. Now, I didn't know, this is just a fascinating account. I love this book, mm-hmm. from a period in American history that has been forgotten. It concerns something called peonage, something that I had never heard of.
We've all heard of peons. But
right, we've heard of peons,
maybe
but
not necessarily
peonage. P-E-O-N-A-G-E. And even the author, Earl, said he was doing research for another book when he stumbled across a story about this. He had never heard of it. So what does a good author do? They said, well, I got to write about this. And he does. So peonage is basically a system of slavery that was alive and well in the American South in the years following the Civil War. And you'll hear Earl talk a lot more about it in depth. But this book takes place 50 years after the Civil War ended. Hmm. And this is still going on. It's call it what you want. It is slavery. And it's 50 years after the Civil War ended in 1921. Hmm. So the book itself concerns, or the story is about a farmer named John Williams and 11 black farmhands who were killed on his farm in the spring of 1921. This book is equal parts thriller, mystery, history book, horror, true crime, and legal thriller, as John Williams faces trial, and this book races to a conclusion that is so exciting. We're awaiting John Williams' fate from an all-white jury of his peers, as well as the black farmhand who did a lot of his bidding for him under the threat of death. What a fascinating read this is. An important book, especially in these still, let's face it, racially charged times. A look at a period of history that has been just swept under the rug and forgotten about. Such a good one. So here now, talking about his book, Hell Put to Shame, this is Earl Swift.
But that was the product of a 14-month stay on Tangier.
Wow. And, 14 but, months.
But years before that, in 1994, my newspaper in Norfolk bought me a sea kayak and let me carve this giant circumnavigation around the bay for 6 weeks on the company's dime.
Wow.
And,
how did
a series
you swing
as
that?
I went and stayed at Love Point. I mean, there's a marina up there on the North Shore just west of the point itself that I kept my kayak at, and the next day I went over to the Baltimore Light and then down the west side of the bay.
Wow. Oh, how about that?
Cool.
Very cool.
That's
very
really cool.
Maybe I could have seen you out there kayaking. Who knows?
But that giant mock-up of the Chesapeake is, you know, one of the most amazing things. The idea that you would have this this model that covered like 3 acres or something.
Yeah, absolutely
just insane. Crazy.
We would every year be the same. All right, time to take the field trip to the Chesapeake Bay model. Okay, all right, okay. Here we are again. When do we get lunch? As a kid, you know, it doesn't mean as much, but yeah, it's good stuff. Speaking of good stuff, Earl, let's talk about your book, Hell Put to Shame. Good God, man, this is what an absolutely riveting book. I was engrossed, enthralled. So I was ashamed at how much I did not know about this story, about this time of history. I mean, how do we not know about, I didn't know anything about peonage. Let's get into it. What was it that inspired you, Earl, to pick up pen and transcribe this story, or laptop, whatever the hell you write with, you know, on your kayak there.
You know, I'm with you, Dave, in this. I had never seen the word peonage in print before.
No. Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that I'm not the only one. Okay.
I hang my head in shame as well. This was a blank spot on the map for me. This whole, you know, the whole subject, the whole period, really. The fact that there was a civil rights movement before World War II, I had no idea that was the case. I mean, I was as ignorant as anybody about the subject, and was working on a completely unrelated book back in 2007 or so about the U.S. highway system. And I was going through microfilm of old New York Times at Old Dominion University in the library there, looking for a brief that appeared somewhere in the bowels of the paper about the 1921 Federal Aid Highway Act that I knew was buried somewhere in a New York Times in March 1921. Mm. And so I was searching for this, and I kept on running into front pages that made reference to peonage and this mass murder in Georgia on what people were calling a murder farm. And I was like, good God, what is this? And so I started reading these stories and pretty quickly kind of abandoned my search for the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1921.
I mean, and, thank you goodness. Know, we got certain levels here. One's on one level and the other.
This was a somewhat more visceral tale.
Yeah.
And so I just started following the stories on the microfilm and realized after an hour of reading that, holy cow, this was something that I ought to know about, knew nothing about. Yeah. And that if that were true of me, then it was probably true of an awful lot of people, and that this was a tale worth retelling. And so that's kind of where it started. Now, that again was 2007, so we're talking almost 17 years ago.
Wow.
And, and so over the course of the next 15 years, I kind of chipped away at the story while I was working on other projects. You know, I'd get a week here, a week there to go down to Georgia and dive into the archives and try to exhume some details, from this long lost story, this long buried story. And finally got to the point where I was able to devote myself full time to it back in.
Oh, did you really? Yeah.
One.
Yeah. This book is so exhaustively researched, and we'll get into your process in a little bit, but can you break down for us a little bit about Pianish? How prevalent was it? What is it, first of all, for a lot of people? And what did it mean to the South, and in particular, the cotton farmers down there?
Sure. Well, Pianish is debt slavery. It's not a uniquely American phenomenon. We didn't invent it. It actually came into the States from South America and Mexico just after the Civil War. And it's where we get the word peons. Peon is somebody who is held in debt, in debt servitude, and cannot escape it. And it's a form of slavery every bit as brutish as chattel slavery was before the Civil War in many respects. And it takes a number of forms. And the form that I concentrate on in this story, a pretty common form in the teens and 20s in the American South, was that if you, a young black man, were arrested, and it was easy to get arrested as a young black man.
It sounds very easy.
Very easy.
Yeah.
You'd be tossed into the county workhouse, and you'd be hit with a fine for, say, vagrancy, not having any money in your pocket when you're stopped by a sheriff. You'd be hit with a fine that you had no expectation of being able to pay.
Wow.
And so you were facing 6 months to a year, probably, in a lot of cases, on the chain gang.
Wow.
For the simple crime of not having a nickel in your pocket.
Right. For just hanging out on the sidewalk.
Right.
Hanging
That's
up.
Vagrancy in that case. So if you have no job or you cannot prove that you're actively searching for work, or even if you can prove that you're actively searching for work, you could be picked up for vagrancy. And so you wind up in jail facing this really disagreeable future. And along comes a farmer who says he'll be willing to pay your fine if you'll come and work for him instead of spending that time in the chain. And it looks like a pretty good deal.
Sweet.
What the depredations of the chain gang look like.
Yeah.
It's not going to be any picnic. How could it be worse to go with this farmer and work with him? And so off you go. And the next thing you know, he has added the cost of your food and board to the fine that you owe. And you realize very quickly that you are digging yourself further and further into debt that cannot be repaid. Have no prospect of being able to make even, and at that point you're a slave, and so that's the form that it takes in this particular case. It took a lot of different forms, some far more subtle. The most common, probably, being if you were a sharecropper and you had a landlord who didn't play by the rules.
Right.
He could make it so that you never got out of debt to him.
Right.
And that was a very common form of Pianish all through the American South. Really so common that I don't know that you can say that it was more common than not within kind of the definition of sharecropping, but it was super common.
Wow.
And,
wow.
A lot of people stuck a lot of people where they were for generations.
Wow. And it's stuff, you get educated, you get an education. I didn't learn about that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Neither did I.
Yeah.
But the effect of it was that although the 13th Amendment banned slavery in the United States, except as a punishment for crimes, for which you've been convicted.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
In reality, slavery just kind of morphed slightly, went somewhat underground, but stayed a healthy part of the Southern economy for 60, 70 years after that.
Wow. You also write about an interesting character in Hugh Dorsey, the governor of Georgia at the time, who, like, you know, eventually, with great risk, publicly spoke out against racial injustice, which was unheard of for a Southern politician at that time. Was he fascinating to write about? He was fascinating to read about.
He was. It made more fascinated by the fact that after he served, he seems to have made a real effort to erase any documentary trace of what he did as governor. He left no papers. He left no diaries or journals. His correspondence is minimalist in the archives down in Georgia. And he kind of just made it really difficult to get to know him. His family reports that they have very little left of his stuff.
Interesting.
So what you're left with is this public record, you know, the kind of the journalistic record of Hugh Dorsey as a guy who did this huge slow turn over the course of his public life from being the prosecutor in the Leo Frank case of 1913, for which he was kind of branded a racist cracker, who went after a Jewish Yankee business manager for a crime that he clearly did not commit, and violated all sorts of rules of law in doing so, to this governor who realized that his state was mired in a way of doing business that could not be sustained if it were going to maintain its place among civilized, you know, civilized governments and a place in civilized society. And so in his second term as governor, again, an office for which he had won on the backs of support from racists who supported what he had done to Leo Frank. Yeah. He does this 180, this slow 180, until by the end of his second term, he produces a document called a statement by Governor Hugh Dorsey as to the state of the Negro in Georgia that is was the most far-reaching and far-sighted pronouncement by a white public official probably anywhere in America, let alone the South.
Wow.
Way ahead of his time, and it's thrilling to read even now. Mm. I mean, it's a document that makes you catch your breath. Mm.
Yeah, and you have a lot of that in the book, and I found myself just really taken by that. A Georgia governor at this time, you know, just denouncing slavery and all the racial atrocities that had occurred. It was just something to, there's something about being a lame duck, I guess.
When you of course, it destroyed him politically.
Sure, yeah, of course.
He couldn't have been elected to any office after he did that, probably, but... But it made an impact, and of course, it attracted international attention.
Yeah. Speaking of fascinating characters, let's get into the case that you describe in your book a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about Clyde Manning. Now, Clyde Manning was peon, who was working on the farm of John S. Williams, and under the threat of death from Williams, killed more than a few of his fellow black peons. This was just what a character this guy is. You couldn't make somebody like this up. To tell us a little bit, I'm assuming the more you found about this guy, the more, you know, taken you were by him. Heart just breaks for him.
First of all, you know, I mean, the story takes place on an 1,100 acre cotton and corn farm in Jasper County, Georgia, which is about 40 miles southeast of Atlanta. And of course, back in 1921, it might as well have been a million miles from Atlanta. It was a completely different state out there in the back blocks of Georgia. And the farm was owned by a guy named John S. Williams. He was 54 years old. He had 12 children. Three of his older sons helped him run the farm. They managed the biggest piece of the property, about 5 miles from his home place in Jasper County. And they all had working for them two classes of black farmhand. They had two families, the Freemans and the Mannings, who actually lived on the property and earned wages of one form or another while they worked there. And then you had that workforce augmented by peons whom Williamson and Sons would bail out of local jails. And so Clyde Manning was a field hand for a field boss for Williams. He was not a peon.
Okay.
He was one of the families who lived there, had lived there for years. His mom lived on the property with him, his uncles, his aunts, all of his brothers and sisters.
Right, that's true, yeah.
And Clyde was 27 years old when the story opens. And a guy who had lived on the Williams farm since he was 13 and who really knew no other existence other than the very hard life of living under a stern taskmaster like Williams, who was, to put it very mildly, a tough boss.
Not a nice guy.
He worked his workforce from well before dawn to well after dark, 6 days a week, and was liberal with the whip for offenses real and imagined. You didn't actually have to do anything wrong to get whipped and beaten to within an inch of your life on the Williams plantation in 1921. And at some point, for a number of reasons that really make no sense at all, Williams decided that he had to kill a significant piece of his workforce and enlisted Clyde Manning to help him.
Wow.
And did so with the threat that if he didn't help him, Clyde Manning would be the next guy who died.
Mm. You
know, he'd start with him.
Right.
And that proved to be a pretty compelling sales pitch from John S. Williams. Clyde Manning became this unwilling accomplice to a mass murder that unfolded in the spring of that year.
Wow.
And which John S. Williams would have gotten away with.
Yeah.
His peons would have been missed by no one.
Right.
You know, they were all miles away from home. They've been bailed out of jails in Atlanta, most of them, Atlanta and Macon. And, you know, this is at a time when communication between counties was virtually non-existent for regular people, for especially black people. He wound up having to explain himself down the road, and that really leads to some of the most dramatic portions of the book, I think. Manning's he's the centerpiece witness at John S. Williams's trial, and then goes on trial himself for his role in the thing.
Wow. Were you able to interview any people for a case this old, or did you just mostly rely on, you know, historical records and I know the newspapers and things like that?
Well, I tracked down the descendants of both the Williams family and and his victims. And so I was able to talk to some people a couple of generations removed, but there's no one left who was alive on the property at the time. You know, the close, you know, it's a shame. Most of the black workers on the farm, once this case ended and they were kind of scattered, they all left Jasper County pretty much. They either died within a very few years young ages, or they lived really long and not long enough for me to talk to them.
Yeah, sure. That would have been a very long time.
They lived into a lot of them lived into the 80s, 90s, even the early
80s.
Now, granted, some of them, like, there were some younger kids on the plantation who just have died within the last few years. They wouldn't have been much help anyway. They were too little at the time to understand what was happening around them. But there were people who were deeply involved in the story who lived surprisingly long lives.
Wow.
I was able to talk to some of their kids, which helped.
That's good.
Interesting. Did they, and were you getting stuff from them, like details that their parents had passed down or thoughts, or what kind of stuff did you get from like the sons and daughters?
The interesting thing is that on both sides of this story, among the Williams descendants and among the descendants of John S. Williams's victims and the descendants of other black workers, the two families on the farm, nobody heard anything
Oh.
Really?
Oh.
Neither side participant, the participants in neither side talked about.
Not talked about.
Put it behind them. So the Williams kids grew up having no clue that grandpa and, you know, their uncles were indicted for murder.
Wow.
And the victims' kids had no idea what their parents had gone through. Had no idea in some cases that their parents and grandparents had been key witnesses at a trial best remembered because it saw a white man, a prosperous white farmer, put on trial solely on the testimony of black workers, which was unheard of at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the detail. I mean, I can't imagine when you stumble across a detail like this. Here's John S. Williams on trial for all these murders. There's a recess in court. He's having a picnic lunch and he eats three pieces of apple pie. Stand up and do a little jig when you get a detail like that? That tells you everything you need to know about the guy.
He was not stressed. He was fully confident. And he had every reason to believe that this was going to go the way all trials like this went, which was you go through the charade of a trial with testimony and whatnot. The jury retires for 5 minutes and comes back with an acquittal, and you walk home a free man.
Right. And we don't want to.
No reason to think this was going to go any other way.
Yeah.
And we don't. Of course, can't get into the way it really went.
No, we won't. And I didn't know. I mean, I was sweating it out. I had no idea how the verdict came out. And it turned, your book just turns into this gripping courtroom thriller with the objections, everything you want in a legal thriller. A courtroom drama is in this book with the lawyers, with the objections, the absurdest closing arguments. Oh my goodness.
The closing arguments are off the chain. I mean, they're just insane. But and I was lucky because the case had generated such interest.
Yeah.
And that was mostly a function of, it wasn't so much a function, I don't think, of the fact that there had been a mass killing of black people. I think it was the style of the killing that attracted people's attention. This was so cruel, so wantonly nasty.
Yeah.
You know, the approach he took to offing his workforce that, you know, that's what made it the headline in the South. It's one thing to get the New York press all up in arms about something going on in rural Georgia. Another thing entirely when it's the Atlanta Journal writing that stuff, you know, in 1921. Wow. But in this case, I mean, that I think everybody, because there was so much interest from the press, from all over, local and otherwise, there was just a record of what was said in the courtroom that it was wonderful. I mean, as for a researcher,
I was able
to find not only the official record, but to find it then amplified by all of this press coverage. And, you know, a lot of the reporters were paying attention to, you know, the body English of the lawyers and the witnesses and the, you know, the atmosphere in the room. And, you know, and so you get a lot of stuff that the official record just can't telegraph very effectively.
And then you also have, I think Williams' lawyer, let's see, what is it?
The defense attorney.
Speculating that Manning's relatives were cannibals, which kind of reminds me of a certain former president, something he might do as well to get the gag order on him.
I mean, Craig Johnson pulled out all the stops in his defense of John S. Williams.
Oh, my goodness.
And again, you know, what he says is so unthinkable today. What he says in open court, it's outrageous.
It is outrageous.
But it wasn't outrageous in 1921. It was kind of standard fare.
Yeah.
And it was, and he used it because it had been effective before.
Oh.
And, you know, Green S. Johnson was, Green F. Johnson, rather, was a very good lawyer. And he does not come off particularly well when given his closing statement.
He's not going to be kind to this guy, no.
The argument he used, effective though it had been, is just so disagreeable. So
so
disagreeable is a good word.
That's a great word. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. The word's not big enough to capture just wrong. Everything that comes out of the guy's mouth is. But.
Well, and speaking of things that come out of guys' mouths, in this book, I mean, it shocked me. And I know you had a little mea culpa, not a mea culpa, but an explanation of why you include the N. Like, even like the FBI guys are going around throwing the N-word around like it's, and this is in the 1920s. It's really shocking for me just to see that and think about that, how it was used so liberally.
Well, it casually, you know, without even a thought. Yes. That's the thing that got me.
Yeah.
And I think most folks, I'm deeply uncomfortable with that word.
Of course.
Really find it offensive and really struggled as to whether I should remain true to the time, authentic to the period in telling the story, because it comes up so often. But you're right. You had federal agents, the good guys, using the word, using the word just in passing. It had no weight to it at all at the time. It was just a label that was thrown around. And then you see it used in open court by former judges even. Yeah, it's just...
That's wild. It's mind-boggling, but it really does help paint the picture of the times, you know. So,
yeah. And this is a time when my grandfather, my grandparents were alive. I'm assuming yours were too. And it gets you thinking. If you were to go back and meet your grandparents in those days, or your great grandparents, would you be happy with the people you met? I don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. It given that it was so wall to wall, this kind of baked in racism that we demonstrated as a society back then, you have to wonder,
you do.
What kind of stock are we from?
Yeah,
that's true. And you always hear about these people who, have Alzheimer's or dementia, and then all of a sudden they're like, why is grandpa talking like this? You know what I mean? They start throwing around these racial epithets. Yeah.
Suddenly they're teenagers again in their heads. And
Yeah.
All right, Earl. Well, let's switch gears a little bit. We're going to take you into our segment we like to call Quick Six. These are six quick questions, which we find out just a little bit more about you. Here we go. Strap in. What is the last show? They're easy questions. So what is the last show? Look, we're not journalists here, okay? We're just podcasters.
We're not.
What is the last show you watched or binged and really enjoyed?
Slow Horses.
Oh,
yeah. Okay, good one.
Finished it a couple weeks ago. Yeah. I'm hungry for season four now.
What fictional world or place would you like to visit?
Fictional.
That's right. I know you like to dabble in the real world, but
yeah, I don't know that I'd like to visit. Really, I mean,
period in history. We'll
sure,
that.
Let's do a period in history then. If you could go back in time,
you're a historian. Yeah.
Well, I've always been fascinated by the turn of the last century. Like, I think going to the 1904 World's Fair in St. Louis would be
good one.
Fantastic, or the 1876 World's Fair in Philadelphia.
Awesome.
Half the invasive species we have in the country seem to have been introduced at that Philadelphia world. So it'd be nice to go back and just say, no,
send it back to Russia.
English ivy yet. Yeah.
I love that it's Philadelphia, too.
Yeah, of course, it's Philly.
St. Louis especially. There's something about the 1904 World's Fair that just it just seems like it was a magical time.
Was that the arch? Is that when they put the arch up?
They put the arch up in 1965.
Okay. Dave. All right. What do I know? I told you. I'm just
made of stainless steel. For goodness' sake.
Come on, man.
Look, I'm a theater teacher.
You've been
right?
in the arch.
I've been in the thing. Yeah.
No, it is where. I guess the world's largest Ferris wheel made its appearance there after being used in the 1893 Chicago Exposition, and then. The art museum in St. Louis still dates from that. Supposedly the ice cream cone made its first appearance there. Oh. Maybe the hot dog, maybe not.
Interesting.
But
it'd be fun for you to check out. Yeah, sample the food. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, just it was kind of a weird time fashion-wise, cars were in their earliest incarnation at that point. Yeah, the curved dash Oldsmobile was the first mass-produced car in America, and it was, you know, it was all over the streets, and but the Model T hadn't been introduced yet. So it was this weird, everything was, it was a moment at which everything was about to change. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't really a recognition that so much change was coming so fast. But so it's this meeting between the old ways and the new, the 19th century, the Civil War, and the 20th century, you know, and all the industrial progress that was made.
Sounds like a good book. Do you know anybody who writes fascinating
I'm not writing that one. I just want to go there. I don't want to write about
it. All right. Sounds good. How about this, Earl? Give us one of your favorite movies of all time.
Chinatown.
That's a great one. Yeah. I love that one.
Yeah, Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Roman Polanski in that one. Director, of course.
Oh, did he?
But he does make an appearance.
He does a cameo, with a knife. Yeah. Hey, kitty cat.
That's right.
Think you're a tough guy, huh?
Yeah, creepy. Yeah.
How about one of your favorite books?
The Magus. Fiction.
What is it?
John Fowles, Magus.
Yeah, I know John Fowles.
Oh, okay.
I don't know that book. Yeah.
Oh. It's... It's spectacular. It's a rabbit hole that once you dip in, you're not getting out.
That's awesome.
I like the sound of that. That sounds good.
The movie adaptation was like the worst movie ever.
They always are. Earl, how about this? Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
Well, go-to and karaoke are not phrases that I would normally put in the same sentence referring to my own behavior. I guess the answer is no. I do not. There's no signature tune that I rely on.
That's really sounds funny. Good. Your daughter wouldn't say that you belt out this particular song very well.
No. I mean... It might be something by Green Day.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, yeah. We've seen them in concert. Love Green Day. Yeah. Good one. Absolutely.
They're on tour again this summer.
That's right.
I see them.
Very excited about that.
We are, too.
Yeah, we are coming out here to Denver. We're very, very excited.
Yeah.
Coors Field. We'll be there.
Last but not least, what book are you currently reading?
I'm just finishing a novel called The Path of Minor Planets. Oh, came out 15 or so years ago, was recognized as a notable book by a lot of big papers and such, and then kind of vanished. But it's terrific. I've really enjoyed it. And I'll finish it tonight, as a matter of fact. I'm about 10 pages from the end right now.
Oh, wow. That's close. Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of fantastic books, Earl, I can't tell you how much I found your book, Hell Put to Shame. Absolutely riveting. Could not put it down. Such an incredible read. A great story and very important right now to be read. So I'm really glad you unearthed this story and wrote about it.
Well, guys, thank you so much for reading it. And, for having me in to talk about it, because I'm excited about it, too. It's a story that seems right for the time.
It does.
And, and it's, as you mentioned, a period of history that's a blank.
It is a blank.
It needs not to be.
That's right. And looking forward to listening to that. I got the audiobook of your Chesapeake Bay book. So I'll be starting that today. I'm excited.
Fantastic. Well, thank you.
Yeah absolutely. Have a great day, Earl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks so much for having me.
You got it. Bye-bye. The Inside Flip. All right, there you go. That was Earl Swift talking about his book, Hell Put to Shame. Really, really good. Excellent read. Couldn't recommend it highly enough. Hopefully you guys check that one out. That'll do it for us for this Inside Chat. We'll be back later this week with Andrew Dowd and a full Inside Flap, including book recommendations. Until then, my name is Dave Mitikas. See ya.
Adios.
Oh,